A Your Vote 2016 conversation with U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree. Democrat Shelley Pingree is facing Mark Holbrook in the race for Maine's 1st Congressional District. If she wins, it will be her 5th term representing Southern Maine in Congress. Pingree describes herself as a progressive. Among other things, she has led efforts to reform U.S. farm policy. She supports grants for alternative energy sources such as solar, wind, and tidal energy. She opposes the Trans-Pacific Trade Deal. And she endorses efforts to reduce gun violence. I'm Jennifer Rooks. During this election season, we have extended an invitation to all 4 congressional candidates. Today, it's Shelley Pingree's turn to answer your questions about the issues that matter to you. A special Your Vote 2016 edition of Maine Calling is next. But first, these news headlines. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling with a Your Vote 2016 election special. With me today, the Democratic candidate for Maine's 1st Congressional District seat, Shelley Pingree. First elected to Congress in 2008, Shelley Pingree is running for her 5th term. Early in her career, she served in Maine's State Senate and was the Senate Majority Leader for 4 years. She also headed Common Cause and is a small business owner. She's here today to talk about her priorities as she seeks to hold her congressional seat against Republican challenger Mark Holbrook. Shelley, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thanks for having me.
As always, we'd love to have you join our conversation. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Shelley Pingree, why do you want to go back to Washington?
Yeah, that's kind of a good question. Sometimes people say that, like, why would you want to go back to Washington? But look, I feel very privileged to have served the state of Maine for the last 8 years. And each time we run for office, I think it's a chance to ask the voters, you know, how do you feel about this job that I've been doing? Do you agree with me on the issues? Would you like to see different things happen? This is kind of a conversation with the voters every election. And I don't blame people right now for being very frustrated with the gridlock, the lack of anything going on in Washington. I just try to make my focus on those things that we can accomplish. Work on the issues that I think Mainers care about. And I do believe I represent kind of the common sense approach of the 1st Congressional District, not really liberal, not really conservative, but somewhere sort of looking at how do we solve the problems people are facing and how do we fight for the things Mainers care about.
What do you think is the most or will be the most important issue facing Congress in the next couple of years?
You know, number one has to be just getting Congress back to work, getting our country moving forward again. We really have suffered through a lot of gridlock. I think the Republicans have been very oppositional in the House of Representatives, opposed the president. They said from day one, we're going to stop this man in his tracks everywhere he can go. And also it's been somewhat of a do-nothing Congress, not taking up some of the challenging bills we have before us, not dealing with the economic challenges before us, rebuilding our infrastructure, making education affordable. Clearly, we have challenges to make the Affordable Care Act more reasonable and workable for people. So we've got our work cut out for us. And I'm hoping after this election cycle, we have some changes in Washington, or at the very least, people return to their seats saying, wow, I really heard from the voters that it's time to get something done and I'm going back to go to work.
Are you optimistic that will happen?
You know, I am an eternal optimist. I truly believe in the democratic process. I, think we are in a great nation. And I do believe that, Americans have high expectations for us. And I like to think that my colleagues will rise to the task.
Okay, to some of the other big issues, the Affordable Care Act headlines this week that premiums are going up an average of 25% across the nation. What would you as a representative support to get the Affordable Care Act into a more workable place for most Americans?
Well, there's a variety of things that need to be done that could be done. And I want to say at the outset, people always ask me how I feel about single-payer health care. Back when I was a state legislator, I was a supporter of it. I think it would have been great for Congress in 2008 after that election to pass a single-payer health care plan. I think in many ways we wouldn't be dealing with exactly the same challenges. But what we have is the Affordable Care Act. And for the last 6 years, when the Republicans have controlled the House of Representatives, they have basically voted to repeal it over 60 times. And you can't take a huge piece of legislation like that that started to become part of the fabric of how we do health care in this country and say, let's just repeal it and throw it away. It truly has challenges. And with virtually every piece of major legislation that's come before our country, Medicare, Social Security. Congress has gone back in 2 years, 4 years later and said, hey, let's tinker with this. Let's fix this. Let's rethink the competitive side of it. Let's do some things differently. And because we've been basically blocked from doing that, it's either been repeal it or nothing. We've been in this position. We can't change it. And I think everybody knows there are things in the Affordable Care Act that have really made a big difference and people care about. Things like keeping your child on the plan till they're 26, which is great if you've got a kid coming out of college or community college and can't find a job right away. You can't be denied for a pre-existing condition, which has really revolutionized how you can get health care. But clearly, with the costs rising and the challenges for small businesses covering their employees or individuals making it affordable, it's difficult. So there's plenty of things we could do, and I'll just highlight a couple of big ones. Clearly, in the state of Maine, the governor's been oppositional to accepting the subsidies. It's about $500 million that the state of Maine really turns back to the federal government, won't take. That would make this affordable for a lot more Mainers, and I would like to see the legislature really override the governor if he continues to disagree on this, so that that federal money that belongs in our state that's going to go to some other state if we don't use it gets used by Maine people. A big issue that I worked on in the state legislature is around the cost of prescription drugs. I mean, part of these cost increases are the outrageous cost of prescription drugs. And we've heard, you know, everything from the EpiPen story to really just basically people's story every day. When I was in the legislature, we worked on a bill that would allow the United States to negotiate for the price of prescription drugs. It would have allowed Maine in that time, but the United States should do it. We're the only Western nation that doesn't negotiate those costs. So, you know, people in Maine know if you go across the Canadian border and you can purchase your medications there, sometimes you'll pay a third of the price. And that's a huge cost savings and really critical. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done. The most important thing is Congress just has to, you know, get moving, deal with some of these challenges and bring more competition into the system.
Tomorrow, our program on Maine Calling is about bringing broadband internet service to rural areas of the state. I know this is an issue that's important to you. What is the role of the federal government? What do you believe ought to be the role of the federal government in making sure that everyone in rural states has access to high-speed internet?
Oh, I think it's critically important. It's expensive for a state like ours to have to subsidize the cost of getting rural broadband everywhere. I think we all know with, you know, the Time Warner cable truck isn't coming down a lot of rural roads and isn't going to necessarily make that investment. And so it becomes a federal or a state investment to enhance our infrastructure. And in today's economy, you can't think about operating a business in a remote location if your customers can't access you on the internet. Maine is a state that's highly dependent on tourism. If you want your customers to find your lodge up in a northern Maine lake, they're going to search it out on the internet, and you've got to have the broadband to respond to them and to, you know, make sure that you can stay in touch. I'm lucky enough to own an inn myself, so I know how much this has changed in the last decade. Customers find you in that way. So, and you know, you make reservations in that way. You deal with the whole system. It also has become critically important for those people who would like to live in rural Maine and can telecommute or could take their job with them. You know, the vital young people we want to have move back into our state often can bring their job with them, but you can't do that unless you can access relatively high-speed internet. And there's a lot of communities in Maine that don't have that. Just to kind of look at apparel, you know, traditionally in this country, we had the REA, the Rural Electrification Association, which pretty much, you know, planted the poles across the country. It made it clear that rural American, agricultural American needed to have electricity in order to move forward. I think in many ways we're in exactly the same place. So these federal dollars are really important. I sit on the Agriculture Appropriations Committee, and actually a fair amount of money for that comes through that committee. Maine has accessed some money around it, but I think this would be the time for Congress to say, this is part of our infrastructure improvement for this nation. It's cheap borrowing right now. Let's make this investment and get our entire country connected, and people having that can have that economic opportunity.
You speak of the Agricultural Committee, and I want to bring up the topic of food waste. We just happened to do a program on Maine Calling very recently on the topic. I know that this has been a big concern for you to reduce food waste and that you've introduced legislation. How though, can Congress affect how we utilize food. You're not going in people's kitchens.
Yeah, well, that would probably make me very unpopular right away, unless I offered to clean up the dishes while I was in there and pick up your trash and take it out with me. Well, I mean, Congress can look at this because, again, some of our federal policies are moving us in the wrong direction. The bill I've put forward is actually a very comprehensive bill and lots of little pieces, and I'm happy to have people go to our website and look at each part of it, and I don't want to bore you today with every little part, but just some of the general thoughts around it. We waste, most estimates are that we waste about 40% of the food in this country, which is really unthinkable. I mean, look, most of us had a grandmother that said, do not waste your food. And, you know, these are Mainers who are Yankees who just don't like to throw anything away. So the idea that we would do that, and do that particularly in a time when so many people in this country are going hungry or not able to access healthy foods, means that we have to fix this system. So we've looked at everything from, you know, the tax incentives to have retail stores and restaurants make sure that more of their food goes to donating to food banks or directly to individuals rather than being thrown away. Same with farmers, tax incentives to have people come through your field after the U.S. grade A produce is picked to glean some of the things that might be a little bit ugly or a little bit damaged, but probably taste great and would feed a lot of people. We've looked at sections to do the same in school cafeterias. You know, kids are great sources of changing public policy. And if you get kids involved in things like recycling, they go home and tell their parents, hey, we can't throw away our cans and bottles. Same with food waste. I think helping kids to figure out how do you put things on a share table if you're not going to eat it. What does food waste in the cafeteria look like? One of the best parts of this bill is looking at the date labeling on food. And we actually separated out that in a separate bill. And that's just virtually that thing you see on, you know, a box of crackers or a can of soup, and it's a date. And most people find that very confusing, myself included. And most people find in their household, one person will say, let's eat that food. And the other person says, oh, throw it away. It's no good. Well, we want to get some sensibility in those labels. Those aren't actually regulated by the federal government. The manufacturer puts the date on there, and it should either say, you know, this would be best if you eat it by X date, or this expires as unsafe by a certain date. So that would actually eliminate an enormous amount of waste. It would probably be the most cost-effective thing that we could do. One last thing on the other side, and I'll stop on this topic, but we also have incentives in there for when things finally get to be waste, like so that municipal landfills are encouraged to do more anaerobic digestion, turn it into electricity or composting, because waste in a landfill produces some of the most toxic gases that we're dealing with today and certainly contributes to global warming, climate change, and whatever, and we should be incentivizing communities to do the opposite.
I'm sure you know, because you've been in debates and forums with him, one of the big issues of your opponent, Mark Holbrook, is the VA, the Veterans Administration, and making a way for it to serve veterans better. He would like to privatize more aspects of the VA, though not all. Do you believe that the Veterans Administration needs reform? And if so, what do you think needs to be done?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Veterans Administration has needed a lot of reform along the way, and we've been actively engaged in that process. And I think many members of Congress have been very frustrated about the kind of giant inability of the VA to give the best service to their customers. We've tackled this issue most recently around the VA Choice Program. That was one of the responses to try to speed up appointments. The VA actually contracted out to a private company, and people had some of the longest wait times and most difficulties getting appointments that they'd experienced in years. So it actually got a little bit worse in there. We went right to the secretary and said they needed to rebid the contract and do something about it. And they actually took some of those things back in-house. And I think that's one way of understanding that, you know, privatizing isn't always a solution, and doing things in-house isn't always going to work the best either. And it's taken a lot of attention on the fact of on the part of members of Congress to, you know, lean on them, talk about getting the bureaucracy streamlined. These records aren't easy to access, and sometimes there's not very good communication between the Department of Defense and the VA, so that once you're discharged, you can't always get access to your VA records as easily. So we're very well aware of the size of the problem. We're very dedicated to keeping our eye on everything and, frankly, to increasing the funding. One of the challenges has been that many of our returning vets from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan have had challenges that the VA wasn't paying attention to before, whether it's brain injuries, PTSD, military sexual trauma, a lot of things that they really weren't equipped to deal with, including dealing with women veterans. And we've had to make sure that they put a lot more resources into that. We're much more aware of how to help vets and their families. And, you know, all you can do is continue to be vigilant and push on them because, as we know, we owe a huge debt to those people who served our country. And Maine is one of the states that has one of the highest percentages per capita of active duty and veterans in the country. So we have a lot of people requiring those services.
Do you see the national debt as a big issue? And if so, how do we fix it?
Well, the national debt, of course, is an issue, and I think we all have to be, you know, very conscious and aware of it. The president has been actively engaged in reducing the national debt, and you'll find that many provisions in congressional rules and laws require us to, you know, cut some funds when we spend more funds, and there's a lot of requirements there to do that. One of the challenges is the national debt continues to grow because of those programs that nobody is likely to change and are only growing in terms of the amount of money that has to be spent. That's Medicare, Social Security, those things that everyone is entitled to receive when they get to that age. But we're getting older, we're getting less healthy, and the costs are going up higher. So it's not a simple solution. And when people just say, you know, let's cut the national debt, the fact is, a lot of the money that gets spent every year with your federal tax dollars is on things that you wouldn't want to have cut on you, your mother, or your grandmother. And the challenges are there's less and less money on those things that we really need to increase our investment in, infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our transportation systems, our aging school buildings, sewer systems, water systems. There's a lot in this country that the federal government isn't doing enough for. And as I said earlier, when interest rates are low and people are out of work, this is the very time we should be investing in that, growing our economy, which will help us in the end to reduce the national debt.
All right. Well, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. If you're just now joining us, our guest, U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree, running for her fifth term in Congress. This is a Maine Calling Your Vote 2016 special edition. We'll be right back.
Your Vote 2016 programming is made possible by your support, along with Lambert Coffin, legal advisors for Maine families in estate planning, probate administration, and will contests. Online at lambertcoffin.com. Also, MEMIC, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy. On the web at MEMIC.com. And the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College, confronting complex issues through innovative programming, service, and scholarship.
When you cast your vote for Maine Public Radio on November 3rd, Super Thursday, the pundits will interpret your action in three ways: that you value this trusted public service for yourself and your communities, that you appreciate the efforts Maine Public has made to bring you more choice and convenience with new programs and the new and growing Maine Public Classical Channel, and also that you want to preserve the Maine Public Radio best practice of keeping the used-to-be-really-annoying fundraising campaigns to just one day long. Hi, Charles Beck here. If any of this rings true with you, please do your part on Super Thursday, November 3rd, or cast your ballot right now by pledging online at mainepublic.org. Thank you.
That's Super Thursday coming up this November 3rd, but you can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a conversation with 1st Congressional District candidate Shelley Pingree, our U.S. representative. This is part of our Your Vote 2016 coverage. You can find all of Your Vote 2016 debates and interviews at mainepublic.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'll start with a Facebook post from Lauren. Understanding that many of the state's funding streams are tied to specific mandates or regulations, what do you see as one or two priorities for improved federal or state policies that could reduce adult and child poverty?
Very good question. Very good question. Well, some of the best federal policies, I think, around helping to reduce poverty in our country have to do with some of the basics that people have really struggled to afford. There are never enough Section 8 housing vouchers. And starting with a stable place to live is the best thing that can happen to a family, and certainly for a child that, you know, doesn't want to be moved all the time. Many children in our state are homeless and live in a homeless shelter every day, or live in a car and get up and go to school. SNAP benefits, an important federal program, really just to help people put food on the table. It's critically important to children and our senior citizens, and that is one way that the federal government helps to support a state like ours. Healthcare benefits. Preventative healthcare is one of the best investments you can make for your child, making sure that they get those appointments, that you find problems early. You look for developmental disabilities and make sure that they get help early. And that comes through a lot of it through Medicaid funding, and we could use, you know, more availability of that in our state and more coverage in our state. Everything we have to do with education, you know, funding elementary education, getting preschool for all kids, more Head Start funding, the places where kids go young. We know so much now about brain development, understand that, you know, the sooner that kids are getting, hooked up with education, the services that they need, and frankly, enough to eat. Making sure a kid has breakfast, lunch, and dinner is really, really important to make sure that you're able to learn that day and able to, develop your brain in the way you want. And so school lunch programs, breakfast programs in some communities, there's summer feeding programs where kids can go pick up lunch in the park. Those just are all important. And I think everything we do generally for families, obviously, in the end, helps those kids.
We'll go to China and Bob. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks. And hi, Shelley. I really love what you've done for Maine and the country. I really support your views, and of course, I'll be voting for you again.
Wow.
Also, I really love the issues that Bernie raised and became a Maine Democratic delegate, and was very disappointed in the DNC last July, the corruption, Debbie Wasserman, the thumb on the scale by the Clinton machine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I damn exited, and I consider myself a progressive, undecided, independent. My question is, can the Democratic Party be saved and become a party again of the people? And what will be your role in either fixing this party or really becoming a progressive and starting a progressive party?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your question. I really appreciate it. And I feel very proud that I came from a state where Bernie Sanders did so incredibly well. And I think it shows how open-minded, progressive, and thoughtful Mainers are. And I think it shows, just as you said, that people want a Democratic Party that represents those progressive values. They don't want a party where you can't tell the Democrats from the Republicans or many of the things that people have been concerned about. Number one, I thought we should get rid of the whole superdelegate situation because it doesn't do anything good to have people show up for their caucuses or primaries, say who they want to elect, and then this whole system of what seems very random to people and is nothing I've ever supported of having superdelegates. And I think it caused a lot of frustration and, just real disappointment. And I agree, the Democratic Party has to spend more time listening to, who we represent, what our voters are. And I truly believe whether it's increasing the minimum wage or affordable health care, focusing on the challenges of climate change, we are the people who are going to take on those issues. And if someone doesn't, There is no future for our children and grandchildren. There's no future for our country without the middle class. So I'm going to continue to be steadfast on all those. I honestly can tell you I don't know how to change a whole national party and do all the things that need to be done. But I'm going to tell you, as one member of a Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives, you know, I don't waver on any of those principles. I think I spend a lot of time trying to convince my colleagues that we are better off representing those things that we've been hearing about from voters, particularly in this election cycle. And I like to think that this election, crazy and frustrating and, discouraging at times as it has been, has really opened up the conversation about what kind of America do we want this to be, and these huge contrasts in the candidates that we've looked at, and the issues that people are talking about, and I intend to be very vigilant with my colleagues if I'm lucky enough to go back to Congress, and particularly those in the Democratic caucus, and say, you know, this is no time to to hold back. America wants us to get something done, and we have to do it.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Going now to an email. This is from Flora in Arundel. She writes, what do you believe Congress and or the president should be doing with regards to the treatment of civilians in the media at the protests of the Dakota Access Pipeline? Do you believe the federal government should support the rights of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and halt the pipeline? And does this issue have any implications for Maine and New England?
Well, it's a really good question, and I do think I'm no scholar of this complicated area of the law. But as you know, Maine has at least four tribes that are federally recognized, and we have some complicated issues here in our own state with the land claim settlement. I'm also lucky enough to have a position on the Interior Appropriations Committee. We have oversight over all funding for tribal matters, and I can just say from what little I have learned at a federal level about our relationship with the tribes is our responsibility is undermet at an extreme level, whether it's funding for tribal health care, tribal education. There are more schools in our country that should be abandoned. I mean, they're just the conditions are so bad. The health conditions for many of the tribes is so woefully underfunded. With the opioid crisis, there's not enough treatment or law enforcement or many things and that are needed out there right now. And all of these situations are similar here to what we have in Maine. And you're asking questions around, the very sovereignty of the tribe and these questions being brought up about, you know, what rights are there within the tribe to stop something that they don't agree with the environmental soundness of. And some of those very same issues have come up here in Maine around the Penobscot River. And as you know, there's a lot of division of thinking there. But I have to say I've really had my eyes open being able to look at this at a federal level. And I think that our country is woefully inadequate in how we manage our relationships with the tribe. Obviously, we have a lot of rights to wrong over time, and I think need to be much more thoughtful about this in the future.
We'll move on to Naples and Dick. Hi, Dick. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to ask Shelley the importance of climate change, and if she'd like to talk about that, please.
Sure, and thanks for the question. I just have to say as an aside, I love the fact that we have a state where you can get a call from Naples, you can get a call from China, you know. And
it's my favorite part of the program.
yeah. I'm, Norwegian by descent, so I hope they'll call in too, this is such a critical issue, and I've heard people raise the question of, all these presidential debates and, the junk that got discussed and debated during this time and very little, if any, on things like climate change. And I can just say I'm worried. I do not want my grandchildren, someday to look back and say, like, hey, what was my grandmother doing in Congress all that time? Our kids don't have a future here, or my grandchildren's children. I mean, we're on a terrible track, and I do not see an answer in sight if we don't, one, just get over with this stupid idea that we think we can deny that there's something going on. I mean, that's ludicrous, although I have a lot of colleagues who that's what they prefer to do every day. And then second, we have to take some real serious action looking into it in the future. I was engaged when we had, the Arctic Conference came here to Portland, Maine. And it was really interesting. Representatives from the 8 Arctic nations and Maine and Alaska both participated in it. So we had our colleagues from Alaska and we got to view a lot of scientific presentations, and a lot of Mainers showed up and listened to some of these things that were going on. Well, the conversations about ocean warming, you know, every Mainer should be able to see that slideshow and to know that the Gulf of Maine is warming at a rate 99.9% faster than the rest of all of the other oceans in the world. And if that doesn't scare all of us and make us want to do something differently, I don't know what will. I mean, that's going to have a huge impact on our fisheries. It already is having some impact, and it's not something that's easily reversed. So I think it's got to be number one topic of conversation. Of course, there are multitudes of ideas that we don't even get a chance to discuss, whether it's a carbon tax or you know, trading of carbons, or whether it's other alternatives. But just the very idea of supporting renewable energy and trying to reduce the amount of carbon in our atmosphere, organic farming, getting more organic matter back in the soil. Organic matter sequesters a tremendous amount of carbon. And as everyone knows, we've turned away from that in our industrial agricultural system. So there's many, many things we can do. We know what we need to do. We just have to stop denying that this is a very serious problem. And we are responsible in this generation to do something about it looking forward.
All right, Dick, thanks so much for your call. Going to go to an email from Andrew. He writes, do you think Congress has a role in addressing problems of racism and white privilege that have become apparent since Ferguson, Missouri?
Oh, I think we do. I think many of those, because they are federal policies, they go all the way from our voting rights, some of which are being eroded now by policies that are being allowed in states around the country, issues around poverty, making sure that people have equal opportunities. And that goes back to some of those things we addressed earlier. Affordable housing, availability of jobs, being paid a decent wage when you go to work at a job. A good opportunity for a good education. You know, schools should be funded equally around our country, or at least at levels that everybody has a fair chance. College affordability, community colleges, access to health care and preventative health care, access to healthy food. I mean, so many of these things contribute to what are the opportunities available for you in your community? Do you really have an equal chance, or do some of the federal policies that we've developed over the years really skew that and make it possible, you know, for some people to just have a much better opportunity than others?
We'll go to Southwest Harbor and Lindy. Hi, Lindy. Go ahead.
Hi there. I want to greet you with the title of Miss Pingree, because you deserve all the respect that I could possibly give you.
Thank you.
I love your work. I moved in on Mount Desert Island, and this summer we had over 3 million people come just to MDI alone. Now, that is a lot of carbon dioxide emissions. And I was wondering if you knew that just recently, within the last week or so, details on the effect of 400-plus parts million atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide are associated with warming of the Arctic. Now, that's a heavy statement to make. And when people are reporting, such as yourself and a lot of other wonderful people conscious of climate change, that a number 400 plus parts per million needs to be broken down so the average citizen can understand it.
Lindy, do you have a question for the Congresswoman?
I was wondering if Ms. Pingree understands that concept of 400 plus parts per million.
Okay, go ahead.
Great. Well, thank you for bringing that up. And feel free to call me Shelley anytime, but I appreciate your thoughts. And I do know, I've heard a lot about that particular number is a threshold number. We thought it would take us forever to get to that number, and now we are either there or perilously close. So I know what you're talking about. And I do think in this horrendous climate of pretending that we can deny climate change, we've had so many sort of false arguments against the science, and that has prevented us from moving forward on what we can do, things that are very workable, very doable, to make sure we can have some impact on what's going on in the future. You're right. You were talking about being on Mount Desert Island, you know, one of the wonderful gems of Maine. Maine is just full of treasures and gems, and I happen to be on the Oversight Committee for the National Parks. We learn a lot about the parks, and of course, Acadia is one of the most popular in the country. It's very accessible. People plan their entire vacations from all over the Eastern Seaboard and the rest of the country to get there. And it's a challenging place because of the bottleneck getting across the bridge and getting traffic over there. And I know, you know, they have been working so hard to find transportation systems that work for people or to reduce some of the traffic, both because it changes the community so much, but also it's just somewhat unworkable. So I'm very sympathetic. That's often a bigger challenge for Acadia because the parks are somewhat underfunded, even though they're a really critical national treasure. And for a lot of people, they're one great opportunity to have an outdoor experience with their families in a very affordable way. So kind of in two problems there, I think we need to help the parks to meet that need for people that's just really, really important for families and individuals. And again, you're right. I think we have to get beyond this ridiculous denial that something is going on here with our climate and allow people to have really vigorous conversations about what we want to do. There are lots of things to do. And again, I'd say I think Maine people are well aware of this. I feel like, you know, fishermen were some of the first people who were coming to me quite a long time ago saying, you know, I don't know what's going on exactly, but I'm seeing species in my lobster traps that I never would have expected here, or I'm witnessing this problem. And now, you know, we can actually document a little bit of the movement of lobsters, you know, further down the coast, as we'd say. You know, they're not as prevalent in southern Maine, and they're more prevalent the further you go along the coast. And that could have just an enormous impact on us economically, culturally, you know, tourism-wise, about our heritage. It's just not something we can ignore.
This is a Your Vote 2016 Maine Calling Conversation with Democrat Shelley Pingree. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments.
Your Vote 2016 programming is made possible by your support, along with the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College, confronting complex issues through innovative programming, service, and scholarship. Also by MEMIC, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy, on the web at MEMIC.com. And Lambert Coffin, advocating for individuals and businesses in Maine trial courts and administrative agencies, online at LambertCoffin.com.
Pam Rector became a single mother by choice 17 years ago. Liv Anestad is just embarking on that journey.
Do people judge you for this when they find out that you did it on your own?
My folks were not so keen on the idea. My dad said to me, "You're just having a midlife crisis. Why don't you just get a red car or something?"
I'm Robert Siegel. Our series, Been There, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered coming up from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening with Nora Flaherty. And ahead in 20 minutes or so here in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, Speaking in Maine takes us next to Waterville and a recent Maine Council of Churches event with former Senator George Mitchell. His talk was From Mudslinging to Mutual Respect, How to Make Politics More Civil.
What's wrong? Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today, a Your Vote 2016 program. Shelley Pingree joins me to talk about why she is running for another term as representative of Maine's 1st Congressional District. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Stevie, who is in West Rockport. Hi, Stevie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Shelley.
Hi.
Shelley, I'm calling just to insert a little bit of humor into an otherwise kind of dismal political campaign year. Alan and I had moved here in 1986, and when you ran for your first office in the state of Maine, you ran against the man who held our mortgage. We had bought his house. And in the first debate you had with him, of course, there was the infamous, "You're a woman from away," and I was also a woman from away, and so I had been resenting, you know, the whole campaign to begin with, but decided with Dave Jackson to write a letter to the editor in terms of how I felt about you, even though we had just recently moved here. And the humor comes in that the other day I was listening to either radio or TV, and lo and behold, on comes a commercial that says Shelley Pingree really isn't a Mainer. She doesn't really represent Maine because she just flies into her island and out of her island, and that's the only time she's around. So I found that all these years later very humorous, and you know, hopefully that's the end of that. But
well, anyway. thank you. Well,
thank you for all the years of everything you've done, and I love living in your state.
Thank you, and thank you for that. That's very kind of you, and thank you for writing a letter to the editor all those years ago. I feel very fortunate, and I will say it's a funny thing about Maine. I you know, truth be told, I was born in Minnesota. At least it's an M state, and I didn't come to Maine until I was a teenager. But we do have a thing in New England about, you know, like, how long have you lived here? Were you born here? And I don't think I've ever had a political opponent, if they were born in Maine, who doesn't try to say, oh, you know, she's not really from here. Well, I mean, I'm 61 years old, so I've been here over 40, 45 years. I've lived in the same little island town, lucky me. And it's a hardworking community of like all of Maine's 14-year-olds islands, of tradespeople and fishermen and you know, people who have to take an hour-long ferry ride to come and go every day. So when somebody calls it sort of an isolated, you know, offshore exclusive place, it's like, well, you come live there for a while and you take the ferry on a rough day and see if it's really – it's just not for the faint at heart. But I totally understand. If you weren't born in Maine, and even though I have grandchildren who are – My children were born here. They all went to high school here. My grandchildren were born here. I've still had people say, like, well, yeah, but their grandparents were from away. So, you know, they can't really be Mainers. So it's just one of those things we do. And it's I guess I would say, you know, I've felt very welcome, and I feel proud to represent first my state legislative district in this one. But I would also say, you know, this is a state where we're unfortunately getting old at a very rapid rate. We're one of the oldest states in the nation. And it's not a good time to be saying, you know, we don't want anyone to move into our state. We need those employees. We need those new businesses. And we want to be a vital young state going into the future.
Stevie, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to an email now. This is from Evie. How can we retain and bring more young people to Maine?
Oh, good question. There you go. Well, you know, I'm constantly impressed at the amazing young people that I meet. Some of them, you know, grew up here and have found a way to stay, found a good job. Some of them move away for a while, and then they know, like, when they have kids or when they want to settle down, they really want to come back to Maine. And people, a lot of young people bring very creative jobs with them. They bring telecommuting jobs that they, you know, started somewhere else, but their boss is happy to keep them on here. They bring creative entrepreneurial ideas. You just look at some of the great companies, the Bixby bars, the, you know, the agricultural products are being done in our state. Some of the computer programming companies. I mean, there's a lot of young, vital ideas here. But you got to remember, you got to have the infrastructure for them. You've got to have that broadband we were talking about before. If you want to populate all the rural communities in our state, you got to be able to do that. I do a lot of work on trying to enhance funding and support for agriculture. I'm on the Agricultural Appropriations Committee, and we do everything we can to take some of that money away from the big cotton and corn subsidies and get it back into New England states like ours, where we once were the breadbasket, you know, for a big part of the country, and we could be again. And we are seeing, unlike other states, the average age of our farmers are starting to go down. We have more women getting into farming than other states. We have new land under cultivation. And you got to remember that the newer, younger farmers who are coming in, again, they want access to the internet. They want people to sign up for their CSA online. They want to sell at the farmer's market with a handheld device. All these things are critically important to encouraging that. So, I mean, that's, I think, a big part of it. The infrastructure, you know, good quality education. When people want to raise their families, they want that available. You know, we can't have a state that turns its back on newcomers, whether they're asylum seekers who are coming from a war-torn country but have, you know, college degrees and want to make a better place for their family, or our own returning young people who want to come back, just want to have a good job or want to be able to afford their life in Maine. That's a really, really important role for our state, and I think there are great opportunities for us. Let's face it, We're all here because this is a beautiful place, because we have safe communities, because we feel good about our rural economy and our rural state, because we love it for the hunting, fishing, snowmobiling, whatever it is. There are a lot of other people who would like to join us here.
We're going to go to Camden and Richard. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, Shelley. This is Richard from Camden by way of Vinyl Haven.
Hi.
Sitting here at the ferry terminal in Rockland watching the North Haven Ferry berth. But that said, my concern is with the role of money, and specifically dark money, in the political process. The question earlier about a progressive agenda by the Democratic Party, really either party has a difficult time, I think, developing an agenda to move a variety of issues forward because of the role of dark money in politics, dark money that funds think tanks in Washington that influence politicians. Dark money certainly that is focused on legislative races at the local level. I wondered what your thoughts are on how that might be rectified in the short term and in the long term.
His is one of several questions about Citizens United and dark money.
Great. Well, thanks for that question, and I wholeheartedly agree. The role of money in politics is it's just not what – this is my opinion. It's not what the Founding Fathers intended. I've never discussed it with them, but I think it's not what was imagined when our country was being formed. And I don't think anyone imagined campaigns growing to the scale that they have today and the amount of money that gets spent. I have been a strong proponent of public financing of elections. Maine started with a system like that in the 2000s. I was involved in the lawsuit to keep it going. When I first got to Congress, I supported a bill testified on it. I got my daughter, who had been in the legislature, too, to come down and testify with my colleagues to understand, you know, we need to revolutionize this system. I've been an opponent of Citizens United. I've, signed on to bills to look at, you know, the fact that corporations shouldn't be treated like citizens. I'm adamant about these things. And I worked for Common Cause for 4 years, which is all about campaign finance reform. It's been a very tough time in Congress. Again, you know, the Republicans have controlled the House for 6 years. They haven't allowed us to bring up any legislation, even on disclosure. Plus, you have a Supreme Court that I think completely misinterprets this. I do not think money should equal free speech. I don't think, again, that the Founding Fathers intended that, you know, your free speech rights were, well, if you can spend more money in an election, you should have more influence in the political process. There are a lot of reforms that we can have. I think it makes it critically important about who appoints the next Supreme Court justice. I think, without a Supreme Court that looks at these things in the right way, it's very difficult to make the changes that we need. And I also think we need a Congress that acknowledges this is just completely out of proportion. We have to change our system. And this is one issue where I know the American public is unified. I think Republicans, Democrats, you know, all demographics, people just do not like this influence of money in politics. They don't like the way the systems work. They can't stand elections. Everybody's tired of the ads right now and all the different influences, on political campaigns. And so I just don't think I don't think change can happen soon enough, but it is a big mountain to climb.
Thanks, Richard, for your question. We have an email from Elaine. In this interview, you've said that you take the national debt seriously, yet many of your solutions include spending more money. How do you reconcile this apparent contradiction?
Well, I do think sometimes you have to spend some money to grow the economy. I mean, I run a small business and any of us who've had this experience, you know, sometimes you have to expand the area of your bar and restaurant to get in more customers. Sometimes you have to make investments in the number of rooms you have in your inn to get more customers. Then you grow, you know, then your bottom line looks better. One of the things we're doing in this country is strangling everything. You know, we're making education unaffordable. We're not investing in early childhood education. We refuse to put money back into our infrastructure now. We can't even pass a decent transportation bill in Congress. That's ridiculous. That means that there's no sufficient funding for states like ours, whether it's roads, inadequate bridges, enough for mass transportation like the rail systems. I mean, all these things that need to be growing. Communities that can't invest in their clean water and their sewage systems. And then new investments in things like renewable energy. things that would really move our country forward, not to mention research and development on our health. We used to be one of the leaders in putting money into the National Institutes of Health, into universities, to research systems. We should be doing that investment right now. Interest rates are as low as they've ever been. People are out of work. This is not complicated. This is sort of a standard equation of how to go about doing it. And if we just try to shrink everything that we're doing, you know, then we shouldn't be surprised that other countries are moving ahead of us or capturing the market in innovation and new technology, and that we're falling behind. And it's just how I believe we have to look at it.
Going to Portland and David, who's on the phone. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Shelley, so much for reminding me that there's still some reasonable, humane individuals in politics.
Thanks.
I really appreciate everything you say. And I just had a really quick question, a comment, and it's about education, which you were just talking about. The funding is inadequate. And I couldn't agree more. I feel as though there's so many different aspects that people are focusing on, whether it's the climate change, which I'm all for, everything that you've discussed and care about, I care about as well. But if there's an umbrella that can cover all of those things and bring us all up together and remove classism and racism and bigotry and horrible things, and is education. I mean, from the ground up. And I don't understand why it's not at the forefront of every election campaign. I hate that I understand why, but I wish it really would bring itself forward as the reason, something we can all get around.
David, thanks so much for your call. We just have a couple minutes left. So as Shelley Pingree addresses your comment, I also want to give her an opportunity to sum up and tell our listeners why you'd like to be reelected to the 1st Congressional District.
Great. Well, thanks. And thanks to everybody who called in today. And I really appreciate your question. And I like the idea that you frame it as sort of like education could be the umbrella for everything that we care about, because you're right. And if there's one thing, you know, that would be that would make me feel great about my public services, it would be if we could end up with a greater emphasis on education and making sure that education is equal. When we talked about the questions earlier about some of the disadvantages in certain communities in our country, a lot of it has to do with you get the right start in life. And education at the college level and community college level is extremely important. But more than anything else, making sure that everybody gets the same kind of opportunity from starting out, you know, that preschool, that early childhood, the Head Start programs, frankly, getting enough to eat before you go to school every day and making sure that you get the services that you need when you're young. And it shouldn't be that some neighborhoods you get a lot of attention, you know, from the time you're young, and other neighborhoods you're forgotten until you're 10 years old and the problems are that much more challenging, or you're so far behind it's hard to catch up. It has a big impact on people's economic opportunities. Frankly, it has a big impact on our prison system and our, you know, who's going to end up with a great opportunity in life and who's going to end up not in the position that they want to be. And I think that that's really how we should look at this country. You know, all too often, I think, particularly with the shrinking of the middle class, you know, some people have great opportunities. Some people can make sure their kids get the places they want to go, or they can, you know, they can start a business. They have the capital behind them. There's just all kinds of things that happen. But it's not there for everybody. And I think if there's one thing that's, you know, for me, an overarching philosophy in the way, you know, I believe people who are elected to these positions should look at things, is that we're all in it together. And it doesn't do me any good, you know, if my kids have all the opportunities, but the people next door, their kids don't get those and they don't have the same start in life. We're all, you know, we're part of one community, whether it's a small town or a state. And we all have to make sure that everybody becomes, you know, is able to fulfill their potential every step along the way. And so that's the way I look at it. You know, it doesn't do any good unless we can make sure everyone has those opportunities.
Well, thank you. Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, the Democratic candidate for Maine's 1st Congressional District. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions as well as our online archives at mainecalling.net. You can find all of our Your Vote 2016 coverage at mainepublic.org/yourvote. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to a special Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.